this bill we pass today will not become law. It'll be changed as time goes by.
Congressman Don Young says more work is needed after he votes in favor of House Republicans' health care reform bill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 4th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, budget cuts have silenced some of the state's earthquake monitoring equipment.
More than a quarter of our monitoring stations are offline as of today.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A Republican bill to replace the Affordable Care Act squeaked through the U.S. House today with help from Congressman Don Young. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin asked Young why he voted for the health care bill after denouncing a prior version as bad for Alaska.
Protesters on the Capitol grounds scolded lawmakers as they left the building. Young says the vote was just one step toward the Republican goal of repealing the Obama health care law.
Well, this bill we pass today will not become law. It'll be changed as time goes by. But unless we move it or move a vehicle, nothing's going to happen, and that's not good.
Under the House bill, Alaskans would lose the generous subsidies available now to help them buy plans on the individual market. Instead, they'd get tax credits that don't vary by location. Young said in March that would be bad for Alaska. Now, he says there are more funds in the bill for high-cost states, and he says House Speaker Paul Ryan and others promised him Alaska will get more help.
I know we have the money, about $19 billion that can be dispersed. I've talked to the Secretary, Dr. Price, and he assures me that we will be made whole if it was to become law.
And Young told reporters his vote for the Speaker's big priority bill makes him more effective on other matters.
You have to have the assurance and the backing of the leadership or your bills don't move. And Alaska has a lot of things on the plate. And I think we're in a better position to get legislation done for Alaska after the vote today than I would have before. Great. You can't figure that out. Same on you. All right, guys.
The bill goes next to the Senate. While Young says it includes protection for people with pre-existing conditions, Senator Lisa Murkowski said Wednesday the House seemed to be undermining the Affordable Care Act on that, the law's most popular feature. And to overcome objections, Murkowski says the House is creating more pots of money.
It was a $15 billion fund, and now we're going to put this fund over here, and it's going to be an $8 billion fund. Is this really, are we building the right policy, or are we just putting enough funds out there to give people comfort that, okay, maybe my state can tap into it?
Governor Bill Walker issued a statement after the House vote saying Alaska would be the state most harmed if the bill is signed into law. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
But Senator Lisa Murkowski was much more enthusiastic about the Senate's passing of a bill that will avoid a government shutdown. Murkowski says the omnibus appropriations bill addresses Alaskans' needs and that a shutdown, however unlikely, would have been disastrous, even if President Trump seemed to welcome the possibility earlier this week.
I don't think that there is ever a good time to say that we should shut the government down. I think our responsibility, our obligation, is to govern. It's to keep the wheels on the bus.
Murkowski says the bill continues funding for essential air service and to keep the 425 Airborne Brigade combat team intact at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson near Anchorage. It also includes an Alaska Mental Health Land Trust exchange in Southeast. The spending bill lacks the steep domestic spending cuts President Trump proposed for 2018, but Murkowski says it's a responsible use of taxpayer dollars. The bill now goes to the president. There are 2 weeks remaining until the legislative session is scheduled to end, but there are few signs of progress on reaching compromises on the budget and a long-term plan to pay for it. Members of the mostly Democratic House majority say the Senate must finish more budget-related bills to allow negotiations to advance. But the Republican House minority wants the majority to start negotiations on bills where the two sides agree. State Revenue Commissioner Randall Hoffbeck says passing a bill drawing money from the permanent fund without other new revenue would leave the state with too large of a budget gap. He says it could hurt the state's credit ratings, which would add millions of dollars in borrowing costs. And Hoffbeck says it would be difficult to plan for spending cuts that the legislature hasn't shown a willingness to make. He says if the legislature passed a budget without a long-term plan, the state would continue to deplete the constitutional budget reserve, an account that shrunk from $13 billion to less than $5 billion in the past 4 years.
The one thing that we are not assuming one way or the other is where this legislature is ultimately going to land when this is all said and done this year. You know, we are hoping for a broad solution. But is there a possibility that when it's all said and done, we get a budget and a CBR draw? You know, that's it could happen.
The session is scheduled to end on May 17th, though it could be extended for up to 10 days if two-thirds of each chamber agree. If lawmakers fail to agree on a budget, Governor Bill Walker would likely call them into a 30-day special session. Members of the Republican-led Senate majority say the House proposal for an income tax would hurt the economy during a recession. An environmental group is praising oil and gas company Hillcorp today after it announced a new pipeline project in Cook Inlet. Hillcorp says the project would eliminate the need to store oil at the Drift River Terminal. That terminal has worried environmental groups for years because it sits at the bottom of Mount Redoubt, an active volcano. Hillcorp says it will build new pipelines and repurpose old ones to avoid Drift River, sending oil straight to the Tesoro refinery in Nikiski. Bob Shavelson of Cook Inlet Keeper is one of Hillcorp's frequent critics, but he says the project is a good idea.
Storing oil at the base of an active volcano is crazy, and the added risk of tankering this oil across Cook Inlet is a heightened risk, so we support bringing the oil across in the pipeline.
The company aims to permit and build the project by the end of next year. Hillcorp executive David Wilkins announced the project during a speech to business leaders in Anchorage this morning. Wilkins also addressed the company's recent difficulties in Cook Inlet. One of its fuel lines in the inlet leaked gas for months, leading to fierce criticism from local environmental groups. Due to that leak and two other incidents, Hillcorp was forced to shut down multiple pipelines and platforms. After the speech, Wilkins says Hillcorp plans to spend more money on inspections to prevent additional leaks in Cook Inlet.
You know, we were going to do a full lessons learned on this, and we will apply it not only to Middle Ground Shoal, but to all the pipelines and platforms and infrastructure. Our goal is not to be having these kind of incidents.
Wilkins says Hillcorp is increasing its spending across the state this year and plans to continue operating in Alaska for decades. Shavelson of Cook Inlet Keeper says he's hopeful that Hillcorp is dealing with the problems that led to the gas leak.
The fact that they've had multiple incidents recently has got their attention, and I see them trying to be more diligent in terms of their operations and their maintenance. So hopefully that will carry on through the future.
Cook Inlet Keeper threatened to sue Hillcorp in February after it learned about the gas leak. But Shavelson says because Hillcorp shut down the gas line, it is no longer pursuing the lawsuit. Attorneys say they're close to reaching agreement in a case brought against the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency by the company pursuing a massive gold and copper mine in southwest Alaska. Attorneys for the government and Pebble Limited Partnership told a judge today that they have identified a likely framework for settlement. They requested a week to try to finalize terms. The Pebble Partnership has accused the EPA of being aligned with critics of the proposed Pebble Mine. EPA in 2014 concluded that the project posed significant risk to salmon and could adversely affect Alaska natives in the Bristol Bay region. EPA has characterized the lawsuit as seeking to undermine its proposal to protect parts of the region from development. Alaska seismologists say continuing budget cuts are affecting their ability to quickly detect and pinpoint earthquakes. KTOO's Matt Miller has the story.
Helena Berman of the Alaska Earthquake Center testified on Saturday before the House Finance Committee's subcommittee on the University of Alaska's budget. Berman said they have a fundamental government responsibility to protect lives and property, but she said 4 years of state budget cuts have affected their ability to maintain their seismic monitoring network.
In August of last year, we suspended most field maintenance of the state's monitoring network. As a result, more than a quarter of our monitoring stations are offline as of today. With the seismic network deteriorating rapidly, an earthquake occurring right now will take longer to detect, longer to assess, and we will do a poorer job.
Berman testified just 2 days before a pair of magnitude 6 earthquakes on Monday morning woke up southeast Alaska residents and caused minor damage in Whitehorse. She explained to lawmakers how their information is important for drafting building codes, setting insurance rates, mapping tsunami evacuation zones, and for engineers as they design every piece of infrastructure or construction project in the state. In a phone interview later, Berman explained how they have 150 seismic monitoring stations located in mostly remote areas around the state. The more stations that are placed around a fault line, the better the speed and accuracy in determining an earthquake's location and magnitude.
There is a seismometer which we dig into the ground and is buried below ground. And then we usually have some sort of hut or structure that holds all the rest of the equipment, and that includes a large bank of batteries to keep the power running. There are solar panels on the side of the hut to keep the batteries charged, and radio communications equipment to transmit the data 24/7.
Berman says about 40 of those 150 stations are currently offline. Some of the common malfunctions include wildlife getting into the huts and chewing on the cables and equipment. Snow can cover the solar panels, which can prevent station batteries from recharging. Part of the communications network can also break down and prevent data from being passed on from a group of nearby operating stations. Some of the bigger outages include southern end of Kodiak Island and north of Yakutat. Berman wrote to North Pole Representative Tammy Wilson that it took 30 minutes to update state emergency officials after Monday's earthquakes. She writes that the national standard is 10 minutes. State seismologist Michael West says the Alaska Earthquake Center gets almost a third of its $2.5 million budget from the state, a third from the federal government, and a third from private corporations for specific projects like monitoring a hydroelectric dam or the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. West says state dollars actually serve as seed funding that leverage federal dollars, which have also been declining. He says only $588,000 may be appropriated by state lawmakers this year. That's down from $800,000 before 2014. Both the House and the Senate have passed their own versions of the state operating budget, but the Senate has delayed negotiations over differences in the bill. West is hopeful that Alaska's congressional delegation will be able to appropriate additional federal funds. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, facing a growing opioid crisis, Alaska addiction specialists disagree on the best way to treat users.
I think it's naive to think that counseling is ineffective.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
For the fifth time in less than a month, Alaska-based U.S. fighter jets have intercepted Russian military aircraft. But this latest incident Wednesday evening is somewhat unique. More planes than usual approached, all while a massive military training exercise is taking place on the other side of the state. Still, as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, military officials and analysts aren't hitting the alarm button.
Here's what John Cornelio can say about this latest incident.
Yesterday evening around 5 o'clock Alaska time, the Alaska North American Aerospace Defense Command region launched aircraft to identify Russian military aircraft that was approaching and later entering the Alaskan Air Defense Identification Zone.
Cornelio is a spokesperson for NORAD, which monitors national boundaries and international airspace near the U.S. and Canada. He says two F-22s flew from J-Bear outside Anchorage to meet a group of Russian aircraft, two long-range bombers flanked by two fighter jets. That last bit is a new development. Amid the recent uptick in these kinds of incidents, there hasn't been a fighter jet present since 2014.
Doesn't happen all that often, but it's not unprecedented.
The planes came within what's called the Air Defense Identification Zone, or ADIZ, a border that extends as many as 200 miles from land. Cornelio says that in the context of Russia expanding its military aviation program over the last decade, none of this is abnormal.
It's important to understand that these Russian military aircraft remained in international airspace and at no time entered U.S. sovereign airspace, which is consistent with how they've always flown.
Cornelio cited security concerns for why he couldn't specify where this latest intercept happened, saying only it was off the coast of western Alaska. That's hundreds of miles from where a massive military exercise is taking place in the Gulf of Alaska right now. But Cornelio says NORAD doesn't believe there's any connection. For the last month, military spokespeople have maintained that they are vigilant but not particularly concerned about the incursions. Cornelio says the number of intercepts in recent years has ranged from zero up to 15. Heather Connolly works for the Center for Strategic and International Studies, analyzing the relationship between the U.S. and Europe with an eye on the Arctic.
What these types of air incursions are meant to do is test readiness.
Connolly spoke with Alaska Public Media the last time there was an intercept at the end of April and says this latest incident fits the same profile. The recent burst of activity could be an effort by Russia to test the capabilities of its new bombers or measure response times across different areas.
That is pretty standard fare.
Connolly says these kinds of military encounters are happening all across Russia's sphere of influence and add up psychologically to create a sense of the country's global reach. She thinks the Trump administration's recent missile attack on an airfield in Syria and increased tension with North Korea may be prompting the Russian military to flex its own muscles.
It does get noticed, it gets commented on, and in some ways, that is exactly what the Kremlin, I'm sure, had in mind. It wants to get our attention and to respond to its growing military power.
Connolly points out the U.S. military does similar aviation testing in international airspace. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly takes public comment tonight on the proposed budget for the upcoming new fiscal year. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, borough spending is up against a cap on property tax revenue, forcing a discerning look at budget priorities.
The proposed $161 million borough budget comes close to current year spending. Borough Chief of Staff Jim Williams says the FY18 budget reflects a trend of rising costs and stagnant revenue.
They're just natural costs that go up, plus some contractual obligations, and you have flat revenues. It's going to intersect at some point, and we're here now.
Over 70% of borough spending is covered by property taxes, and the new budget includes a small tax increase, bringing the borough the closest it's ever been to a limit set under a long-running voter-imposed cap.
The revenue that we're projecting to collect this year is about $9 under the cap. We could put $9 in the budget someplace and be 100%, maybe buy a couple gallons of gas for a vehicle, but we're at the cap.
The cap limits the amount of property tax revenue the borough can take in to what's collected the previous year, with a few exceptions, including revenue from new construction. But Williams says not much of that is happening.
There's not a lot of demand to build new properties, and property values are staying relatively flat. Well, as that stuff stays flat or slightly increases, and when you apply the tax cap formula, it's a kind of the perfect storm of stuff.
With no increase in revenue, Williams says it's important for borough residents to tell the assembly what their priorities are.
We need ideas. I mean, what chess pieces do you want us to move?
The biggest piece is local school funding. The borough mayor's proposal is $4 million short of what the school district is seeking. The district is already laying off teachers and considering other cuts in light of a pending state reduction in school support. The assembly meets tonight at 6. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
In the Matanuska Susitna Bureau, assembly members voted to approve a roughly $400 million budget plan on Wednesday. One major change to the proposed budget last night was a slight increase to school funding. An earlier version of the budget had included flat funding for schools, which school officials said would result in cuts to cover costs. School district officials were looking to get the same 6% increase in school funding as the last 2 years. But in the end, Mat-Su schools got a bump of only about half that. The budget now goes to Borough Mayor Vern Halter, who can make vetoes until May 16th. The state ferry Tustamina will be out of service for longer than anticipated. Meadow Bailey, a public information officer with the Department of Transportation, says the Tustamina had docked for an overhaul with an original return to service date of May 27th.
There was some discovery during its annual overhaul that there was additional extensive steel waste found in the engine room. So that repair will take about 2 months longer to complete.
Bailey says the state is informing passengers about the change. The delay affects Southwest Alaska and communities along the Aleutian chain.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. At Alaska Pacific University, students are surrounded by beauty, distinguished faculty, and independent-minded creative students pursuing higher education. AlaskaPacific.edu, moving life forward with APU. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Bethel police say one of its officers was the driver in a collision last month that left one pedestrian injured and another dead. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Sergeant Kadre Lamadi collided with the two pedestrians near the intersection of Chief Eddie Hoffman Highway in Ravencourt the night of April 22nd. Lamadi declined to comment on the incident. Bethel Police Chief Andrea Shea says the department has seen no reason to discipline the officer.
It was an off-duty incident, and we don't see any criminal activity or anything to take any disciplinary action.
The night was dark and approaching midnight when Lamadi struck the pedestrians along a straight section of highway at around 40 miles per hour. Chief Ashe says Lamadi immediately stopped his Ford Taurus, called 911, and began administering CPR to one pedestrian who was left unconscious by the blow. That pedestrian was 49-year-old Julia Stephen. She was medevaced to an Anchorage hospital where she never regained consciousness and died 4 days later. The other pedestrian was taken to the emergency room in Bethel and treated for non-life-threatening injuries. Chief Ashe says Lamadi was driving the speed limit when the accident occurred. His lights were on and he was in his lane. As far as the police can tell, Lamadi was not driving recklessly.
There's no negligence that we're able to determine from this accident.
Because people got seriously hurt, Lamadi was required by state law to provide a blood sample for toxicology analysis. He also volunteered to give a breath sample. The sample came up clean, indicating no alcohol in Lamani's system. Chief Ashe says the pedestrians might not have been sober. The one with the non-life-threatening injury said they had both been drinking. Police did not give either a breath test. Chief Ashe says the Bethel police have completed their investigation into the accident and have passed it to state troopers for review.
So we have all our avenues covered, make sure we have a clear investigation. There's no question about the integrity of the investigation.
Chief Ashe says the police also contacted the troopers the night of the accident, but the troopers were busy with other calls. The investigation is still waiting on evidence from the state. The toxicology report of Lamani's blood sample, and the autopsy report from the deceased pedestrian, Julia Stephen. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Buprenorphine is one of the medications used to treat opioid addictions. A speaker at a recent medical conference in Anchorage says getting the medication to heroin users through their primary care providers is an essential way to reduce overdose deaths. But some addiction treatment professionals in Alaska say not so fast. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more.
Buprenorphine is a synthetic opioid. It's often combined with another drug and sold as Suboxone. Like heroin, it stimulates receptors in the brain, but to a much lesser degree. Massachusetts family physician Steve Martin has prescribed the medication for years.
The most common response we get from people is, I feel normal now. Without any craving, without any feelings of withdrawal, without feeling like they have to find something right away, without feeling like they can't go to work or take care of their family.
He says buprenorphine doesn't lead to addictions, and it's the cause of fewer than 1% of overdose deaths. He says people need to be on it for at least a year before they taper off, though some have been on it for much longer. The medication has been available since the early 2000s and has been prescribed for long-term use in Europe. Martin spoke to a group of primary care providers from around Alaska during a conference in late April. He said that drug dependence needs to be looked at and treated like any other chronic disease as part of primary care. And just like medical providers don't require counseling for medications to treat depression or diabetes, they shouldn't require it for buprenorphine, a medication to treat addiction.
For a given person, we can't predict whether counseling will be helpful or not. But in randomized trial after randomized trial, people randomized to counseling plus buprenorphine or buprenorphine or Suboxone by itself do equally as well in terms of their recovery.
Martin says some people get support through church or family relationships instead of through formal counseling services. Carl Sodersom, who runs a peer-to-peer addiction recovery support network in Wasilla, disagrees.
I think it's naive to think that counseling isn't effective. I think that we, by just prescribing, we're addressing the biological effects of the individual and keeping them from suffering withdrawal symptoms, but we're not addressing the root causes of the addiction and the underlying behavior that the individual is exhibiting.
He says we can't just rate the success of medications like buprenorphine based on overdose numbers. Recovering is about more than just staying alive. It's reconnecting with a healthier life and community. Anchorage Family Health nurse practitioner Jill Green provides addiction treatment services, primarily a long-acting form of naltrexone called Vivitrol. She says buprenorphine can easily be diverted and sold on the streets. It's a small film that you place under your tongue.
People are getting one-month prescriptions for these medications, which is allowing them the opportunity to divert their medication on the street, which many patients tell me is what they have done, so they can still purchase street drugs.
Green advocates for stronger regulations on the distribution of the drug. Federal laws changed in 2016. Now, doctors who prescribe buprenorphine products like Suboxone and Subutex to treat addiction can increase their patient limit from 100 to 275. Martin says the treatment helps people get their lives back on track, and over-regulating the medication means fewer people will have access to it. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
The federal budget deal cut by Congress includes some good news for arts in Alaska. The compromise continues funding for the National Endowment for the Arts. The federal agency provides about 30% of the Alaska State Council on the Arts annual budget. Chairman Ben Brown says the deal means the council will continue to pass federal money on to Alaska art programs.
When the Office of Management and Budget released the so-called skinny budget a few months ago, there was a draconian proposal to eliminate all funding for the NEA. So we're pleased to see that the NEA is still operating, and there is leadership in place there that supports its continued existence.
While the Alaska legislature's budget isn't complete, House and Senate spending plans keep the council's funding flat. Both chambers have also passed an Arts Council restructuring bill. The measure changes the state agency to a public corporation. Backers say that would help attract additional grants and partnerships. The state council supports art education, training, and performances, as well as community arts groups and individual artists. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Andrew Kitchenman, Matt Miller, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Elizabeth Harbaugh, Zachariah Hughes, Casey Grove, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of operations in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.